Hello and welcome to the Crisis Point podcast. I'm Eric Sammons, your host and the editor-in-chief of Crisis Magazine. I want to be talking today about the recently completed United States Conference of Catholic Bishops meeting, the USCCB meeting last week. And so I'm recording this. I'm live, actually. So if you're watching this on YouTube, feel free to drop your comments in the chat, in the live chat, and I'll see if I can answer if there's any questions, anything like that. But I want to talk about last week's USCCB meeting, and I titled this USCCB United States Completely Clueless Bishops. Now, I know that one of the things that conservative Catholics and traditional Catholics get criticized for is bishop bashing, the idea that we're constantly railing on our bishops, constantly criticizing them. And I try not to engage in bishop bashing. I'm not trying to find things wrong with the bishops in order to just criticize them. Frankly, that's like shooting fish in a barrel. So I don't really see the point in constantly doing that. But this was a big meeting, and I think we need to address it and just really talk about what happened there and how clueless, I mean, that's the word I'll use, how clueless these bishops are about the state of the Catholic Church today. Now, this was the meeting was in Baltimore, and it was the first in-person USCCB meeting since before COVID. So already we see something there that they weren't willing to get together, like, for example, back in June, when frankly, almost everywhere had released their, no longer had their lockdowns or anything like that. But they were still afraid to get together, and so they waited till now. Another thing about it is that the visuals of the meeting are always terrible, and they were particularly terrible this year. What I mean by that is these bishops meet in Baltimore in a hotel conference room, and it looks just like any business's corporate meeting, aside from what they're wearing. But even then, these bishops usually wear their suit clerics. You don't see a bishop in a cassock or anything like that. They're always wearing their suit clerics. And so the idea that this is somehow a spiritual meeting is just missed completely by these visuals. And there's nothing Catholic about it other than the fact that, you had some people with their clerics on, and they usually put up some type of Catholic image up front or something like that. But it's just a hotel conference room. There's nothing to it. I'm not 100% sure if it's a hotel conference room, but I know it's just a conference room. Why not meet, for example, why does it, first of all, have to always be in Baltimore, near Washington, D.C., on the coast? Why can't they meet in Kansas? Why can't they meet at a monastery somewhere? Why do they have to meet in such a secular setting? Now, this year, it was particularly terrible visuals because every single one of the bishops and all the pictures I saw, all the videos I saw, were wearing masks. And that's probably because in Baltimore, there still is a mask mandate in the city. Again, they don't have to have for indoors. Again, they don't have to have the meeting in Baltimore, but they choose to, and they end up all having to wear masks. And I don't know if they probably think that's a good visual, them all wearing masks, because it shows they care. But really, it's another thing that shows that they completely capitulate to the state, that there really is no fire in them. There is really no desire to stand up to the state in any way. And the truth is, it makes them look like scared old men. I mean, I think that's the visual it gives, that they're just a bunch of scared old men who will do what they're told. Not the successors to the apostles who, remember, went out to all the world and preached the gospel and were killed by the state in many cases. They were killed by some, they're martyred by the state because they refused to back down. That's who the bishops are successors to, are those men. Yet what they look like is a bunch of scared old men who are hiding out, wearing their mask. They're afraid of a virus. I'm sure most of them are vaccinated. And so really, it just is some terrible visuals. And I'm not having gotten to what they're talking about yet. And then you had things like, for example, the USCCB Twitter account. Somebody who runs that account thought it'd be cute to have a poll where they said, should the bishops have ice cream during their break? And I think this had to do with they were testing their system for voting, and that's the what they used. That was the question they used. So they put down a Twitter account thinking they're cute. And of course, needless to say, that tweet was getting ratioed faster than you can believe until they turned off replies. And so, because everybody realized it's so tone deaf. I get that the person who's running that is trying to be cute. They probably hired somebody young to run that USCCB Twitter account, And that person knows that you can build up a following by sometimes being witty and cute and doing these polls, things like that. But read the room, people. Read the room. Nobody wants to hear that from the USCCB. Because the fact is that respect for the USCCB, if it ever was high, it's at an all-time low now. And that doesn't necessarily mean that all Catholics don't respect their individual bishops. I was surprised a poll, boy, when was that done? A survey was done recently. Maybe that was the Pillar. I can't remember now. Where it was talking about, do you trust your bishop? Things like that. And many Catholics trust their bishop, which I can't believe, their individual bishop. But even if they trust, they like their local bishop, they still don't really respect the USCCB. It's seen as a kind of faceless bureaucratic institution that doesn't really serve much purpose. And so they don't really get that, though. I think the bishops think they're these leaders that people respect and will follow and listen to, when nobody really does. Another thing is that there was a lot of talk at the conference about the latest church buzzword, which is synodality, because we're in the process of this 2-year synod on synodality over in Rome. And so, for example, the Apostolic Nuncio brings it up, synodality and the importance of it. And it was interesting to see that they brought up synodality also in the drafting of the Eucharistic document that I'll be talking about in a little bit. And really what I've kind of seen, what synodality means is we shut up all the people who aren't going along with the program. That's what synodality means. Let's keep all those people quiet. Because what we do is we promote synodality as we're all together, we're not divided, we're united, and we're working all these things out together. But what it really means is if anybody brings up topics that are uncomfortable or don't go along with the program, then they're shut down, because that's not really part of synodality to have actual real debate. And so that was another thing about this that I noticed at the beginning. So this was kind of the feeling you get at this this meeting of the USCCB. And I think people just, I just don't think they realize that that's what people see when they see them. They see people who use church buzzwords like synodality, who are completely tone deaf with tweets about the ice, you know, should the bishops have ice cream, as if they're our buddies or something like that. The visuals of being in a conference room and having all their masks on, stuff like that, all of that gives such a poor image to the Catholic Church, frankly, in America. And then the other thing was that was interesting. So this is their first meeting since COVID. The first in-person meeting since COVID. Yet, they didn't really address anything related to COVID that they did. For example, I mean, there's a mention of it in, it begins the Eucharistic document. There is a part about that in there, which I'll talk about in a minute, and it's awful. But there's no discussion of the fact that you people shut down all our masses for 2 months. You people have made it so that you feel like you can't walk into a Catholic church, the typical Catholic church, without being worried that you're going to get some over-aggressive usher telling you, hey, here's your sanitizer. Where's your mask? Oh, don't sit too close. Don't get so close to each other. There was no discussion of that. There's no discussion of the fact that basically they've been doing their best. Parishes are doing their best to drive people away. It's not even talked about. The complete capitulation to the state isn't discussed at all. Nobody's bringing that up. And just the fact is that what Catholics want to hear, they're not talking about. I mean, it impacts Catholics a lot. Even if you don't want to talk about their role in this, what about the fact that people are losing their jobs? There's this unjust vaccine mandate, which goes completely against Catholic teaching. Even if you look at what the Vatican's been recently saying, the vaccine mandate completely goes against Catholic teaching. There's no talk about that. There's no talk about the fact that people are potentially losing their jobs because of the vaccine mandate. The fact that our economy is in the tank because of all the stuff that's happened with inflation, things like that. No discussion of a Catholic viewpoint of any of that during the conference, during this meeting. Not one mention of it that I could find. I will say I didn't watch every minute of it. My gosh, I mean, I guess that would have taken a lot of time off purgatory, but I wasn't going to do that. But there's no real serious discussion of these things that impact Catholics. So your typical Catholic, COVID and the COVID restrictions impact his daily life. And yet nothing is really talked about by the bishops of how maybe we can help Catholics to deal with these things. So, and here's another example. So, you know, what they did talk about, the fact that we're going to rename RCIA to OCIA. And in fact, the National Catholic Register, which I like, I'm trying to boot on it, but they did have a headline titled, "Forget RCIA, Meet OCIA. U.S. Bishops Approve Big Name Change." I don't know how one letter is big name change. The only one letter difference that I know is a big deal is the homoousios in the creed. And those who get that will get it. But they talk about that now it's called instead of the rite of Christian initiation for adults, it's now the order of Christian initiation for adults. And essentially what it's doing is it's just renaming the English name for it to be a little bit more in line with the actual Latin name for it. So, I mean, that's all it is. I mean, I don't think they talked about anything about changing how RCIA is. The fact that it's a bureaucratic process that basically does not help anybody. As somebody who's gone through RCIA, I can tell you that. I mean, I know parishes, a lot of traditional parishes, they've just scrapped the idea of RCIA and they do their own program and call it something like adult conversion class or something of that nature. So, I mean, RCIA is now OCIA. Boy, that really affects Catholics worldwide in the country. That's really going to help us live our faith better knowing that. And so you see, you know, it's hard not to be cynical. I guess that's what I'll put it. It's hard not to be cynical when you see how out of touch, how clueless our bishops are when they get together. It just is unbelievable how much it just is not in keeping with the real world. I mean, really. And so I don't know. Okay. Now what I want to talk about though, let's move on. I could just go on about how out of touch it is for a half hour. I'm not going to do that. What I want to talk about though is what was the main item of discussion, the Eucharistic coherence document people were talking about. And so the idea is that back in June when they met online, and that was just hilarious, by the way, the June meeting, because like most of the bishops couldn't get coordinated with their technology and stuff like that. But anyway, back then there was this idea of a Eucharistic coherence document. And it was the media, at least, was reporting, including Catholic media, as something that would talk about whether or not the issue of pro-abortion politicians receiving communion. It wouldn't be the only thing we'd talk about. Nobody ever said that, but it would definitely address that issue. You had people like Archbishop Corleone and Bishop Strickland who were arguing that we need to address this more forcefully. Bishops, or I should say hirelings like Cardinal Supich and Cardinal Gregory saying, no, we don't want to talk about that. It was a big deal. And there was actually public fights about it between bishops, which I think we need more of, by the way. I know people talk about we can't have a divided church, things like that. I think we need more division in order to bring about the truth. So I would love for these bishops to get into more public spats, assuming one side is actually talking about the truth. So essentially what happened was, is that was the idea. So they said, we're going to draft a document, which we will then approve or not approve in the November meeting. So they drafted a document. I think it was sent out to the bishops around September, something like that. And there was talk about how much was it going to bring up in the pro-abortion politicians. Obviously, we have a president of the United States right now who is a Catholic, says he's Catholic, and is pro-abortion. This Nancy Pelosi, Speaker of House, is also so many of these prominent politicians, the governor of New York and others, who are claimed to be Catholic and they're rabidly pro-abortion, they receive communion. Nobody tells them they can't receive communion. And so ultimately though, I think once Pope Francis waded in on it in August or September, I can't remember what it was, when he basically said, you should not deny communion to anybody. And I think I have a podcast where I talked about that. I think it was a foregone conclusion they were going to bring it up. There's no chance in the world that the USCCB is going to have a document that goes against anything that Francis even thinks or suggests. If just the fact that he basically decided on the side of Supich and others, the hirelings, that no, we can't bring this up. We can't deny communion to anybody, essentially, I guess, unless they're a trad trying to receive on the tongue, then basically the die was cast. We are going to have a document that was going to be a big nothing burger. Also, it was interesting. I saw a lot of the reports about this really tried to spin this as if it was some type of process of synodality. That's why you didn't have a big debate at the November meeting, because we had debates back in June and following it, but there was no debate really here. It was like a half hour discussion and then they voted on, and it was an almost unanimous vote. I think it was like maybe over 200 bishops voted against it and a few abstained. So they said this was synodality at work. Well, this is synodality at work, the way they understand it. You get a document that's either meaningless or terrible. I mean, that's the result of synodality. And essentially here, it's meaningless. It wasn't terrible in the sense that it wasn't terrible in what it did say. It was terrible in what it didn't say. And so right now, Catholics, what they want strong leadership. They don't want bureaucrats shuffling papers, creating more documents that will go in the circular file. They don't want politicians, which is essentially what they're acting as. They don't want that. They want successors to the apostles. They want people who are martyrs, who are willing to be martyrs. I mean, does anybody think that in this crop of bishops we have now, that how many of them do we think, if we had to vote, let's say there's 230 bishops in America, how many of them do we think would be willing to be martyred? I mean, obviously, I know the grace of God can work in anybody and give them that grace at the moment. But I mean, as far as how they're acting, I mean, I think most of us can count them on one hand, if even that. However, I will say George Weigel, the neocon Catholic who is always ready to carry water for the USCCB, his analysis was just rosy and saying how great it was. And I will say this was in the National Catholic Report. I'm not going to boot on National Catholic Report. Catholic World Report. I like them. I like what they do. But this was awful. I mean, the fact that they ran this by Weigel, I mean, just says it's all because of Weigel's name, because it was awful, his analysis. I'm not even going to link to it in show notes. If you want to find it, find it. But basically, he said that the mainstream media only talked about the fact that they didn't bring up pro-abortion politicians receiving communion. But really, they did. The document does. In fact, he even says the bishops have now recommitted themselves to the hard work of bringing wayward Catholic public officials to the truth. And they should be supporting those efforts by the people of the church. Oh, my gosh. He says also, he said they didn't duck the abortion issue, which they did. I mean, he was blaming the staff of the USCCB for not like getting ahead of the issue and saying, no, we really are addressing this, when they didn't. And also, like, he talks about the fact that, you know, he actually writes, while Pope St. Paul VI took great care that the documents of the Second Vatican Council were adopted by the greatest possible consistency, he refused to sacrifice truth to a false concept of unity as unanimity on such sharply contested issues as episcopal collegiality or religious freedom. I mean, this is just a rewriting of history Weigel has if he thinks that Vatican II refused to sacrifice the truth in order to get consensus. But basically, Weigel thinks that they did address the issue, that they did really strongly talk about it. When I go through it here in a minute, I'll show that that's simply not true. And so also we have Naumann, Archbishop Naumann, who was the he is the chair of the USCCB's pro-life committee. And so he was talking about, he goes, it was good to reiterate in this document what we have said before about our responsibility to have dialogue and conversation with those who are Catholic, but who act in a way contrary to our faith in this basic moral teaching. We said before, but one of the reasons we need to say it again, because I am not sure that we've taken seriously bishops our responsibility for the care of souls of these politicians to really enter into dialogue. Dialogue, dialogue, dialogue. We all know what dialogue means. Dialogue means nothing will be done. We'll talk and we'll talk and we'll talk. I mean, that's my criticism of Archbishop Corleone, who's great in so many ways, is he's still in the process of dialogue with Nancy Pelosi. By the time that dialogue is over, Nancy Pelosi's great-grandchildren will be dead. I mean, the dialogue is just continual talk without any action. That's what it means. And that's what Archbishop Naumann is saying. Let's continue to dialogue with people like Joe Biden, Nancy Pelosi, and others. But that's meaningless. And here's the thing. They know that. The politicians know that. They love dialogue because they can continue to run cover and on the one hand claim to be Catholic, on the other hand promote rabid pro-abortion policies. It gives them the best of both worlds. And so this idea that somehow dialogue is going to be the solution to problems, that, I mean, I don't know if the bishops actually think that their dialogue will change the minds of people like Biden or Pelosi, if they're really that clueless. Or if, on the other hand, they know it won't, and that's the goal. I think it's actually both. It depends on who it is. I think Supich knows. Supich knows that they're not going to convert because he doesn't want them to convert. Somebody like Archbishop Cardinal Gregory knows that too. These people know it. But I think somebody like Nauman and maybe Corleone, they don't realize it. They actually think that the dialogue will eventually bring about some type of conversion. But if you look at the history of the church, dialogue isn't the way that the church brings about conversion. It's through proclamation of the truth. It's through it's through deeds that are backing up your words. And that's not what we have here. So the chance that they're going to be somehow that people like Biden will magically convert because we dialogue with them is just ludicrous. There's no evidence it's ever happened. So now now the document's called The Mystery of the Eucharist and the Life of the Church. It's actually hard to find online. They didn't make it that obvious where to find it, USCCB website, which might be on purpose. But it actually reflects the fact that this thing will be a forgotten document before you know it. I mean, it's just going to disappear from the life of the church before you know it. And that's why this whole thing has been, like I call it, a big nothing burger. So the document, a couple of things I want to mention. One is that it mostly simply just repeats Catholic teaching. I mean, that's basically all it does. Like I said, it's not saying necessarily things that are bad. It's just not saying things that are good. And so ultimately, it just doesn't really have any effect, because we know, if you know Catholic teaching, you know all these things. If you don't know Catholic teaching, you're not going to read this document. There's millions of documents you could look at, or just the sacred scriptures, and you could know these things. Now, also what I noticed was I actually went through the footnotes. This is something I do with church documents. I go through the footnotes and I try to see how unbalanced it is with what they reference. For example, do they reference everything from post-Vatican II or before? If you look at Pope Francis documents, it's almost 100% Vatican II and after, and mostly just himself. He's quoting him. He's literally footnoting himself. Well, in this document, we had about almost 90 different references. Only 12 of them come from before Vatican II. There's some mentions of the fathers, the church fathers. Aquinas is quoted once. Trent is quoted once. Yay. The Bible a couple times. Post-Vatican II is about 75 out of less than 90 references. Vatican II is referenced 8 times. The Catechism, the Modern Catechism, 16 times. Pope Francis, 14 times. JP II, 10 times. Benedict, 7 times. I mean, so basically, Code of Canon Law, 6 times. So essentially, like all church documents, it's very front-loaded or back-loaded, however you want to look at it, to today. And that's a common thing, and I think that's a problem. I know some people might not think that's a big deal because, oh, you're quoting things that are recent, things like that. But I do think what it does is it furthers this idea that the church basically began at Vatican II, or at least it restarted. There was a reboot at Vatican II, which is why everything they're going to quote is from Vatican II or after that. So that's one issue with it. But then, like, just going through the document, I made some notes on here, and so I'm going to go through this a little bit. So, for example, it starts off talking about the pandemic. And, of course, there's no – it 100% believes the narrative, the mainstream narrative. It doesn't even question it in even the slightest way that everything Fauci and others have said is true. I mean, that's a real problem if our spiritual leaders can't see through the lies that we've been told over and over again by the state. They just simply can't see it. They accept it with blind faith. They accept that more blindly than they accept the words of the sacred scriptures. And so it talks about how we're mindful of how the pandemic has forced us to stay physically distant from one another. Maybe you, but not me. I mean, honestly, other than the first like couple weeks of the pandemic, I haven't been physically distant from people in any way. We all get together like we always have. And for a time to view celebration of the Mass on a television or computer screen. I mean, two things about that. First of all, that's your fault. You're the ones who made it where we couldn't go to Mass except for on a television or computer screen. Secondly, a lot of places are still doing that. They're still streaming Masses, which I think is terrible. I think at most, a diocese should have one streaming Mass available, and that's for people who are homebound. They can't get out. That should be at most what you have. But a lot of parishes now have made streaming Masses a norm. And if that doesn't undercut our belief in the importance of the Eucharist, I don't know what is, because you're not able to attend and receive the Eucharist, adore our Lord in person, then, you know, what's the purpose of it? So, I mean, that's the first thing, is the fact that they don't seem to recognize, there's no call for, let's cut out the streaming Masses. Let's basically make it one. In fact, there's an encouragement of them. So that's something, again, that's something I want to mention, is this document is supposed to increase Catholics' faith in the real presence. It's supposed to increase our Eucharistic devotion. That's the purpose. So remember that. So here's one thing that undercuts that, and they don't say anything about it. In fact, they encourage it, the streaming of masses. So basically, they drop they divide the document up into the gift and the response. The gift is simply what the Eucharist is. It's a restatement of Catholic teaching. Like I said, it's not terrible, but it's mostly front-loaded to recent times, recent documents and statements about it. So it's nothing that any Catholic doesn't already know. Again, it's a waste of paper for people like me who print it out. Now, one thing I did notice, they have this part, they say, the church's firm belief in the real presence of Christ is reflected in the worship that we offer to the Blessed Sacrament in various ways, including Eucharistic exposition, adoration, benediction, Eucharistic processions, and 40-hour devotions. Great. Good things to mention. In addition, the practices of reverently genuflecting before the Blessed Sacrament reserved in the tabernacle, bowing one's head prior to reception of Holy Communion, that you wouldn't do that in the traditional Latin Mass, but that's something done when you're walking up, I guess, and refrain from food and drink for at least 1 hour before receiving communion are clear manifestations of the church's Eucharistic faith. Quiz, what was left out of that? They were talking about these practices like genuflecting for the tabernacle, bowing your head before reception of Holy Communion, refraining from food and drink, fasting for an hour before communion. What did they not mention? Communion in the hand. The fact that communion on the tongue is inherently more reverent than communion on the hand. And yet they will never say anything against communion on the hand. Yet that does diminish our belief in the real presence. It does impact that. So they'll talk about that it's good to genuflect for the Blessed Sacrament, but they will never say it's good to receive on the tongue, even though that still is the norm in the church, even today. And so ultimately, that's a great example there of things they're going to leave out. They're not going to talk about, but that actually have a great impact on the Catholic's Eucharistic faith. Okay, also they talk about, they do have this line where they say, St. Paul emphasizes that this communion that you receive through the Eucharist exists not only among ourselves, but also with those who came before us. Unfortunately, we forget about them all the time. Like I said, we don't even mention them in our documents. Okay, so now we get to a part where it talks about, this is the cringeworthy paragraph, number 32. The gratitude which inspires us to give thanks and worship God in the celebration of the Eucharist should be nurtured and enriched by the beauty of the liturgical action itself. Picture your typical St. Suburbia's parish when you're reading this. Bishops and priests have a particular duty to ensure that the Mass is celebrated in a manner befitting the sacredness of what takes place. As Pope Francis recently wrote to the bishops of the world, I ask you to be vigilant in ensuring that every liturgy be celebrated with decorum and fidelity to the liturgical books promulgated after Vatican Council II, without the eccentricities that can easily degenerate into abuses. And I think a lot of us know where that comes from. That's from the letter that the Pope wrote to the bishops after he issued the motu proprio Traditionis Custodis, the one that basically is trying to restrict the traditional Latin Mass. I feel almost like this is trolling us at this point. I mean, maybe it is on purpose. But the idea that there has ever been anything done to, as the Pope said, be vigilant, ensuring that every liturgy be celebrated decorum and fidelity to the liturgical books. Here's another case where the bishops are completely tone deaf. I mean, actually, I just think they don't realize this. You go to a typical parish, and what you see is not a liturgy that is beautiful, a liturgy that makes you think of the real presence. I mean, a lot of parishes, you walk in, it's a bare building mostly with a couple felt banners, maybe a crucifix and a couple of other things. Very ugly building. There's chatting going on beforehand. No respect for the fact that the tabernacle, our Lord himself is in the sanctuary. And so it does everything to reject devotion to the real presence. And yet there's no mention of this other than the fact that, we should do something to make sure they're beautiful and that there is good decorum and fidelity to the liturgical books. I mean, that was a throwaway line the Pope put in that letter on purpose in order to act like he's not on either extreme. Yet we know nothing is ever done. Nothing is ever done by the bishops to curtail the extremes that we find, the lack of reverence we find. The only thing that is done is what? Restrain the Mass. It is reverent. That is the traditional Latin Mass. That's the only thing that they will do. So, I mean, these are empty words. They're not only empty words. They're contrary to what they're actually doing, directly contrary to it. What else? I'm getting a little bit long here, so I'm going to wrap it up. Okay, now to get to the main point of what people were thinking of, which was the idea of pro-abortion politicians receiving communion. They talk about the fact that we need to, we shouldn't receive in the state of mortal sin. They mention the fact that as Christians, we bear responsibility to promote life and dignity of the human person and to love and to protect the most vulnerable in our midst, the unborn, migrants and refugees, victims of racial injustice, the sick and the elderly. That is what the unborn is to the bishops. It's something in a list that can basically put it equal to other things that are not of equal value. So, for example, obviously what comes next? Migrants and refugees. I'm not claiming that there isn't some issue going on with migrants and refugees that couldn't be improved, but to think that that even comes close to being on the same level as a systematic murder of millions of babies is just ludicrous. It shows you don't really care about the unborn if you put them in a list. They don't deserve to be in a list with all these other groups. Victims of racial injustice, which we know is just code for if we don't like what certain conservatives do. You know, the sick and the elderly, yes, we need to care for them, but to act like that's on the same level as the murder of all these millions of innocent unborn children. But that's how you denigrate the cause of the unborn, is you put them in a list. And also, and then later talks about how Francis has eloquently drawn the connection between the celebration of the Eucharist and the care for the environment. Again, if we want to denigrate our devotion to real presence, attach it to a trendy social cause, a social fad. And so again, essentially what it does, it just says, I'm going to skip some of this because this is getting, I know, a little bit nothing. Oh yeah. So they then come up and they do bring up Canon 915. They do actually bring it up, but they bring it up in a footnote, of course. And they talk about that their money quote. This is what they said basically about the idea of pro-abortion Catholics receiving communion. It is a special responsibility of the diocesan bishop to work to remedy situations that involve public actions at variance with the visible communion of the church and the moral law. Indeed, he must guard the integrity of the sacrament, the visible communion of the church, and the salvation of souls. That's it. That's it. That's all they had to say about it, was what they have always said and done nothing about. There's absolutely nothing about this that is any different than anything else they've ever said about it. So again, like I said, a nothing burger. Now, I will say, I'm going to skip. Oh, I also wanted to mention one of the footnotes was actually quoting Pope Francis, a tweet of Pope Francis's, which I thought was, I don't know, just something. Okay, finally, let me talk real quick also about this National Eucharistic Revival. So they have this document, which we all know will do nothing, will not change anything. It will not change anything in the church. That document will not change one thing. However, they did follow it up by saying they're going to have a National Eucharistic Revival. And so this does sound like action. Sounds like, hey, we might be actually doing something. So it's slated to launch on the Feast of Corpus Christi in 2022 and last for 2 years. The first year will include a study on the belief in the Eucharist, a diocesan toolkit for Corpus Christi processions, and the commissioning of more than 50 Eucharistic preachers who can speak about the power of the Eucharist. And so, okay, first of all, I do like the idea of trying to encourage Corpus Christi processions. That is a good thing. I think processions are one example of how we can increase our devotion to the Blessed Sacrament is through Eucharistic processions. So good for them that they do include that. But again, it's a lot of talk. You know, having these 50 Eucharistic preachers speak about the power of the Eucharist, liturgical actions are far, far more powerful than any words. Even the greatest homily on earth will not have the same power as a liturgical action that's repeated over and over and over again. So if you kneel and receive communion on the tongue, for example, every week for years and years from your birth until you receive first communion for decades, that's going to have far more impact than any sermon you're ever going to hear. And this is something they don't get. It's something that most Catholic leaders haven't gotten and has been a major problem in the church for the last 50, 60 years, is this idea of talking, this didactic way of just, we say things and that will change things. And they don't recognize the power of the liturgy and the liturgical action. When people go up and they receive in the hand and it's and just there's a billion Eucharistic ministers, and it's like a Pez dispenser giving out communion. That has a far greater impact, negative impact, than the greatest sermon. You can have the greatest homily in that mass, but if you finish it, if one of these 50 Eucharistic preachers comes, let's say he does a great job preaching it, but then that parish continues to distribute communion in the same way, you're not going to have any impact. It's not going to have any impact whatsoever. And I think this is something they miss. And so in this revival, it's not going to touch on those things. I'm just honestly not really optimistic and have that great of an impact. The second phase of the revival actually makes it worse. It says the second phase, the parish phase, will launch in June of 2023 with the goal of spreading devotion to the Eucharist on the margins of society, including prisons and the southern U.S. border. We all know what that means. We all know what that means, the southern U.S. border. In other words, it's going to be a political thing. We're going to make it a political thing of the latest fads of the left, and we're going to push that, and we're going to use this Eucharistic revival to do that. And it concludes in 2024 with a National Eucharistic Congress with the hope of gathering 80,000 people for prayer and talks and Eucharistic devotion in Indianapolis. And now, here's the thing. A Eucharistic Congress is a great idea. We used to have those all the time, and thousands of people would go to them. But if it's not backed up by liturgical action that is in keeping with our devotion to the Blessed Sacrament, again, it's going to be worthless. It's not, maybe not worthless, but it's going to have a much less dramatic impact. And this is what I mean when I say the bishops are clueless, is they keep on doing the same thing over and over again and expecting new results. We have had programs for decades. We've had new initiatives for decades. We've done all these things to say, you know, everybody's leaving the church. Nobody believes in the real presence. We have to do something. We have to do something. We do something. Yet all they do is the same thing that keeps on not working. Instead of looking at, okay, let's look at the history of the church. Let's do like St. Paul said, and they mentioned in their document, look at those who came before us. What did they do that helped people to have a Eucharistic faith? They had reverent liturgies. They had things like, they didn't allow communion in the hand. They didn't have a billion and one Eucharistic ministers. They didn't have any late Eucharistic ministers. Those are the things that they did that help foster. They didn't have to have a program. That's the thing, is they didn't need a program to foster Eucharistic devotion 500 years ago or 100 years ago, whatever, because of the fact they had it built into the system, so to speak. Yes, there were times when you needed to have maybe preaching about it. You may need to have some congresses about it, some revivals about it. I get that. That happens. Our faith gets lax. But this is just yet another thing in a long list of failed programs that they're doing. And so ultimately, I just feel like I'm just not optimistic that this is going to be something that helps Catholics, that's going to increase. In fact, I would just say right now we know that Catholic belief in the real presence hovers around 30%. Some surveys say as high as 40, 30 is probably more accurate. After this 2-year Eucharistic revival, this document, will that change at all? I would argue that I would predict that it won't. I mean, if in 2 years I'm wrong and it's gone up and it's better, I'm thankful. I'm glad. I just don't think that's going to happen. Essentially, what we're doing is they're shuffling the chairs on the deck of the Titanic. The Catholic Church is, in America in particular, is in dire straits. And this meeting does nothing to really slow that down, slow the descent down. And I think that's sad. I think ultimately what we need to do is lay people. So what should we do as lay people? I think what we need to do is we need to pray for the bishops, pray for them, pray for our priests. I think we also need to encourage Eucharistic devotion in our parishes where we can make an impact. Like, obviously, if you're not receiving on the tongue now, please receive on the tongue. Try to go to a parish where obviously that's allowed, but also with an altar rail. I mean, altar rails are another way because they do two things. First, they divide the sanctuary from the nave. So there's this idea that there's something special going on up there. And also, you know, receiving while kneeling is a very reverent way to receive. So do things like that. Encourage your bishop to have Eucharistic adoration, to encourage people to receive on the tongue, to receive kneeling on an altar rail, things like that. That's what we can do as lay people. We can pray in front of the Blessed Sacrament for these things as well. I think that's really that's all we can do, is we can encourage, we can pray, we can do all we can to make sure we have reverence. And especially if you have kids, teach them these things from a young age. If your kid is receiving on the tongue while kneeling and he's going to a Latin mass or at least a mass that is very reverent, and he's doing it from birth, I think he's going to be a lot more likely to one day believe in the real presence than if those things aren't happening. Okay. And like I said, I'm running a little bit long here, but I think this is important to talk about. And I just encourage everybody to pray, everybody to do penance for our bishops, do penance that, you know, for sacrileges against the Blessed Sacrament that go on all the time. And until next time, God love you.